You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
There's a team based in Toronto that at any given point in time employs some of the most skilled and experienced journalists in the country. Newsroom leaders from Canada's top broadcasters and newspapers. But they're just a part of the team. This team also has had a former member of parliament, high-powered lawyers, researchers and pollsters, and top-level strategists from both ends of the political spectrum. The people on this team don't just have experience in news and PR and government and business. They also have connections and influence across the board and at the highest levels. And here's the most important part. This team has resources, seemingly limitless reserves of cash to do their work. This organization that I'm describing, it's not a newsroom. It's sort of the opposite of a newsroom. You see, their specialty is not reporting information to the public. What they do, big part of what they do anyhow, is work day and night to keep information from the public. Or, if they can't do that, they've got a whole toolbox of strategies, ways that they can warp and manipulate the way that the public thinks about things, or distract us, or even just bury us in so much conflicting information that we all just get bored and move on. The organization that I'm talking about is called Navigator Limited, the crisis communications firm that has played a largely secretive but pivotal role in many of the major Canadian news stories you have heard over the last decade and beyond. Their client list is confidential, and their policy is to never confirm or deny when they're asked which people, companies, or institutions they work for. So they don't talk about their clients, and they don't talk about themselves. Their founder, Jamie Watt, would not sit down and give us an interview. "Nothing much to say," Navigator once told the Globe and Mail. "We're not very interesting, I'm afraid." But their refusal to publicly talk about the work that they do in the public sphere, well, that does make it challenging to report on them. In order to figure out who they are, how they came to be, and what they have done, well, you need to search under the cushions. Collect the breadcrumbs, read a lot of documents, and keep very good files. Our news editor, Jonathan Goldsby, has done just that. And in a moment, he will join me for the Canada Land Guide to Navigator Limited. Jonathan, when I think about Navigator, I immediately just think of Jamie Watt, the principal, I guess the founder of the company. But I realize I don't actually know much about the guy. Who is Jamie Watt?
Just to start, I want you to read this ad that ran in the Globe and Mail, sort of like a classified-like ad, but wasn't exactly classified, in December 1980.
December 1980, yeah. Globe and Mail. J.S. Watt & Co. Clothing for Men. Last-minute shopping? Trust Jamie Watt and his men to have lots of fresh new ideas. Drop in at J.S. Watt & Co., formerly The Casual Affair, and you'll find the traditionals. Jaeger, Terry Williams, Johnson, Merritt, Dior, Cardin. Shirts and ties in silk, wool, stripes, patterns, plain, and novelty ties.
Mm-hmm.
For that really special guy, Jamie Watt has a velvet cord jacket at $175. That sounds pretty expensive for 1980. Socks in a can by Vagden make fine stocking stuffers. What more can we say? 224 Lakeshore Road East, Old Oakville. So he was the men's clothier.
Yeah. Before he was a crisis management strategist, a political operator, before he was an advertising executive, before anything else, he was a men's clothier in Oakville, Ontario.
I mean, that's, I guess, an interesting bit of trivia about Jamie Watt. What is the relevance? Is there any connection, I guess, between his initial role as a men's clothier and his ultimate role as the Navigator guy?
So after he was a men's clothier, he moved to London, Ontario, where he got involved in the advertising industry. He had a firm called Cohen and Watt. And through that, he built up, you know, client base, and he eventually got into politics, successfully stick handling a lot of the advertising and messaging of the Ontario PC's successful 1995 election campaign.
Hi, I'm Mike Harris. When you elected our government, we listened to you. We promised we'd lower your taxes to create good jobs, turn welfare into work, and protect our health care systems. The Common Sense Revolution is a plan of action to strengthen our province. A better and brighter Ontario is waiting on the horizon. Let's go there together. Thank you.
Okay, he got involved with the Conservative Party.
Exactly. But some of the stuff that happened in Oakville in that sort of period while he was a clothier eventually ended up catching up to him.
What do you mean?
Shortly after Mike Harris, the new premier, took office in 1995, he had run for office, I should say, on a sort of program of populist austerity, sort of Thatchery, bringing into Ontario these, you know, the ideas of like, let's just portray the poor as lazy and go after welfare. The Common Sense Revolution, exactly. And so Jamie Watt's first big media debut in this context, in this realm, was a profile in the Toronto Star by Kelly Tuffhill that came out in the middle, like about a month after Harris was elected. It's kind of the dead of summer. She did a sort of a semi-puffy piece about the Group of Seven who helped Mike make his mark. I'll just read you the lead of it. In ordinary circumstances, it would not be particularly noteworthy that Jamie Watt is gay. But Jamie Watt is not in ordinary circumstances. The 35-year-old advertising legend is one of the most important people in Ontario's new Progressive Conservative government, part of a very small, tight-knit band of advisors who helped Premier Mike Harris make his most important decisions. It seems a contradiction at first that a man active in gay causes is a top advisor to a right-wing premier who opposes expanding gay rights. What happened next wasn't actually even about that. It was about the fact of the article itself. It was about suddenly here he was being written about in the Toronto Star. I believe the story ran on the front page. He was credited as sort of the architect of this Common Sense Revolution, the person who came up with who helped distill a lot of the ideas into this messaging and branding that ultimately brought the Progressive Conservatives to power. So it was a good positive profile of Jamie Watt, but there was a bit of a factual discrepancy that was discovered after it was published. So the article said that he had moved to London, Ontario at the age of 20 and had gotten into advertising then, but it didn't mention his years in Oakville as a men's clothier. And it turns out that during that time in the mid-80s, just before he moved to London, Ontario, he had pled guilty to 5 counts of fraud and 1 count of forgery relating to bank documents he'd fabricated in order to trick a bunch of Oakville residents, like other fellow business people, etc., to loaning him a total of $19,000.
He had pled guilty to financial fraud?
Yes, basically, to forging documents to obtain loans on false pretenses.
Around the time when he was a men's clothier?
Basically, he was trying to get these loans in order to keep his business afloat.
Wow. And then goes into advertising, becomes a legend, according to Kelly Tuffhill.
Yeah, in between, he was sentenced to 30 days in jail. He served like 2/3 of that.
And oh, he went to jail?
Yeah, well, because an overnight.
For fraud?
Yeah, for about 2.5-3 weeks, and just overnight things. So, but yeah, he did go to jail for that brief period.
And it's so interesting that getting good press as being credited for being the architect of this political victory, as a backlash to good press, it's like that's when somebody said, oh, that's not exactly true. I know the real truth about this guy, and then the dirt comes out. His political career was cut short basically because his past caught up with him, and there was a media scandal.
Yeah, and basically it was cut short. His career in, I guess, inside government was cut short. Certainly not his career around government, but his career inside government was cut short. He ended up, you know, getting more like contracts to work for the Conservatives as soon as like a few months later. So he was still involved. But this was a big deal that he resigned because, well, the Conservatives had, you know, sold the papers. Like, well, he didn't tell us about this. I mean, it's hard to say how much that was true. But, yeah, he resigned, and he wasn't really offering comment in those initial stories either. What I have always taken from this is that through this experience, he learned that it's better to get ahead of a crisis than let someone else define it.
I get it. So this basically is like the superhero origin story of Navigator. Like, he's the best guy to get you through a media crisis because he's been through it himself.
I mean, Navigators, a big part of what they do is trying to get ahead of stories. And there are a lot of different ways that can take place. But in this case, for example, you could imagine he could have basically gone out, admitted that this had happened, but that he, you know, become a different person or move past this or what have you, and put it in his own terms, or was that it wasn't something that people would come at as a surprise, you know, be surprising him with, like, oh, we got you, but rather be the one to volunteer the information, for example, and frame it in a way that is, I guess, has a more, and in the context of a narrative that's more favorable. Once again, like, that's a lot of sort of the backbone of how this company operates.
I see what you mean. The fact that the truth about Jamie Watt was so contradictory to this, you know, very positive idea of him as this sort of political superstar. If he had just integrated that into his story, if he had told his bosses about it, and if he had told the Toronto Star, mm-hmm. oh, I have a checkered past, but I've learned so much from it.
It's not hard to imagine that being like an inspiring story in a newspaper, right? Like, you could easily imagine it being framed that way if someone were to volunteer and go like, hey, I'll tell you the story, but like, this is, you know, this is how I want to feel about it. And you know, that's part of crisis management.
How does he parlay this experience into this company? How does this become Navigator? And what is Navigator?
He founded Navigator in 2000. And at first it was kind of just like a market research and polling firm. And they still do that. Like, if you go back to like some of the earliest versions of their website, it's like around like, hey, we have this poll on a conservative leadership race that appears in the National Post. And it's kind of like a political polling and in polling marketing firm type that. There's no shortage of those things out there.
Yeah. There are dozens of strategy firms, research firms that we would never dedicate an episode of Canada Land towards. They're pretty banal. Navigator has a very singular and specific place. Like, how does that happen?
So over the course of that decade, it kind of gradually started moving into other areas. And what distinguishes them is that they don't really do any one thing. They're not just a strategy firm. They're not just a lobbying firm. They're not just a polling firm. They're not just a crisis management firm. And for a while, they themselves had a hard time exactly putting a finger on and sort of defining what is it that distinguishes us from all these other companies that maybe do one little bits and pieces of this, but not what we do. They particularly, their kind of idea was that they are a company that will be hired by an individual, but usually a corporation, sometimes or sometimes a government or sometimes a party, and will, through various means and methods learned from the world of politics, go to bat for them, whether that means getting good press and just advancing a campaign for around a particular policy or against a particular policy. And they'll apply these lessons learned in the world of politics to all manners of communications and advocacy. There's actually a case study in a book, a 2015 business book called Why Should I Choose You? Answering the Most Important Question in Business in 7 Words or Less by Ian Chimandi and Ken Aber. They run a company or consultancy called Blueprint Business Architect. Their whole thing is basically, how do you distill the entire raison d'etre of your company, everything, into 7 words or less? And with Navigator, they hit it at 6. Something that basically, yeah, it functions as a slogan, but also in a sort of a central principle around which the whole company can be oriented. So basically, they tried to figure out, how do we define what we do that is special and distinct and unique and that has an appropriate price attached to that?
And so what's the 6-word slogan they came up with?
When you can't afford to lose.
When you can't afford to lose. I mean, I knew that. It really is very good.
It's an excellent slogan, although it's more fun when you consider it as like a jingle. Navigator, when you can't afford to lose. It's a lot less intense that way.
I don't think you'd be in such a jovial mood. Like, this is like, the pitch is, you have built something, you are a major corporation or you are a celebrity, you have something to lose, and you can't afford to lose it. This is for all the marbles.
That's exactly it. It's partly about playing on emotion, and it's about playing on a sense of threat.
Yeah. And it tells you, before you even pick up the phone, this is going to cost you an arm and a leg, because you really have no other option.
Yeah, in that respect, it's almost like a luxury brand, I suppose. Not a lot of businesses. I mean, maybe the type of business where that sort of boutique nature or high-class nature of it is built into its very brand, into its very marketing. This is how the consultants who helped them come up with this core proposition explained the value of it to the company and how it binds it all together.
Okay.
What we could all agree was the common thread tying all of Navigator's clients together was that they felt as if they were under some sort of threat, but not necessarily in a crisis. In the client's minds, the consequences of these threats were far more grave than your garden variety marketing or sales dilemma. When we asked why the employees of this company were so good at what they do, we were told that they had all come from the world of politics, where with the mindset and skill set were so clearly focused on winning. If you didn't win, you lost. There is no second place. There's first place and last place and nothing in between. So when you're under threat, do you want to hire people who have marketing and communication skills to help you? Or do you want a team of people who are absolutely tenacious when it comes to winning?
That's interesting, because it seems like you've got a bunch of people. And this was another thing that I think these kind of young Turks of Mike Harris, of Stephen Harper, mm-hmm. they were known for being like vicious, real politic, smart, strategic political thinkers. So here you see taking the skill set of like politics is not business where like second place you could still make billions of dollars. It's win or lose. And you're trying to take down your opponent's reputation or preserve your own, taking those types of combat strategies into a PR arena. You don't want to be thought of as like, we're not providing you market research. Mm-hmm. We're not.
Although they do that. But yeah, exactly.
But they're not branding themselves because, as you read, that's a dime a dozen. We're here when you can't afford to lose and when the choices are winning or losing. So who has needed these services? Who has availed themselves of Navigator?
So Navigator generally doesn't disclose or confirm who its clients are. They'll often decline to answer media questions, including some of the ones we sent for this episode, by explaining that they have contractual obligations to their clients that preclude them from talking about their client work. That said, through many reports over the years and various means, their identities and associations with various clients have emerged. Sometimes it's like if they're actually doing lobbying activity for a client, and lobbying is a small part of what they do, that'll be in a lobbyist registry somewhere. Or, for example, often, you know, their representatives will reach out to journalists on, you know, behalf of the client. And sometimes the journalists will report that, oh, we got a call from Navigator on this file.
Right.
So over the years...
Court filings.
Sometimes
if it's a
court
public
filing.
Expense that has to be disclosed.
Yep, sometimes official processes. So stuff comes out now and again.
So the default is secrecy. We're not supposed to know because you wouldn't want somebody to know that you had to retain Navigator if you could avoid it in many cases, I would imagine.
Often, yes.
And so when we learned about them, that's the exception, not the rule. So you have to imagine there's a lot more than the ones we know about. Who are the ones we know about?
This is a very incomplete list, but just some of the people and companies and organizations they've worked with in at least one respect have included Gian Gomeshi, Michelle Latimer, Chick-fil-A, We Charity, Soul Pepper Theatre, Hockey Canada, The Globe and Mail, Nordstar, which is the company that owns the Toronto Star, Brian Mulroney, the Ottawa Police Service, Enbridge, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Food Banks of Canada, Clorox, Kraft Heinz, Pride Toronto, Labatt, Bell, Rogers, Microsoft.
Prime ministers, the biggest companies in the world, the biggest celebrities in the country, people on both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah, generally speaking, yeah, liberal and conservative organizations.
All right, so these are very, very famous companies and people, former prime minister. They're famous, but Navigator's not supposed to be famous. Like, how did Navigator get famous?
Let me ask you this, Jesse. When was the first time that you can recall hearing about Navigator?
Michael Bryant.
Yeah, myself as well. And I think that really was kind of their big debut in this other larger sphere.
I guess maybe because their work there was so effective, you had to wonder who the hell pulled this off.
For those listeners who are outside of Ontario and or don't remember, Michael Bryant was basically, he was a hotshot lawyer who was elected to the Ontario legislature as a liberal member of provincial parliament when he was in his early 30s. And then when the Liberals took power in 2003, he became the province's attorney general at the age of 37. Eventually, you know, he shuffled different minister positions. He resigned from the legislature in the spring of 2009 to head up a new City of Toronto agency. But then just before the end of the summer in 2009, while out driving with his wife, he killed the cyclist, a courier named Darcy Allen Shepherd. Bryant was charged with criminal negligence and dangerous driving causing death. And there was a whole altercation leading up to that fatal impact. And there were a lot of witnesses and things were not looking good for Bryant.
I remember that he was known as an incredibly talented rising star, but he was also known as a hothead. And here he is in like a convertible sports car. And there was no question that this altercation with Darcy Allen Shepherd and eyewitness accounts of the car speeding off and slamming Darcy Allen Shepherd to his death on the side of Bloor Street, it was not looking good.
Yeah, it was not looking good. But within a couple of days, the media attention, the narrative began to shift a bit. It began to focus more questions, like questions to police, began to focus more on Shepherd, the man who was killed, and all the reasons that he might have actually been the one at fault, with reporters peppering police with questions about, like, maybe did Darcy Allen Shepherd try to grab Michael Bryant's steering wheel? Did he try to put Michael Bryant in a headlock? And the Star reported at the time that, you know, a police spokesperson found himself wondering where all that stuff was coming from.
Yeah. You know, I remember the indelible image that ran all over the place of Darcy Allen Shepherd in an altercation with a driver of a car, in that, like, that just seems like a nightmare as a motorist, right? To have this angry, you know, kind of punk rock looking cyclist in the driver's side window threatening you. Of course, this was a completely different altercation, but I think that in the public imagination, this brought up a lot of questions, even if the eyewitness accounts had nothing like that. And what struck me about the outcome, you know, I've often thought of Navigator as, you know, you've got your lawyer for court, And then who represents you in the court of public opinion? And that's Navigator. And,
yes.
You know, these days optics being very important, but, you know, we still think of the courts as having a primacy, like your very freedom is at risk, and the court should be sort of in a separate protected place from this court of public opinion. But it seemed to me that Navigator was so successful in changing that narrative that it actually changed the court outcome, because Marie Hanen,
his lawyer, and lawyers, generally speaking, lawyers often work in close conjunction and coordination
right,
with crisis management firms, which also would put crisis management firms sometimes under solicitor client privilege.
It's not that ultimately a court determined that Michael Bryant at trial was determined to not be guilty of manslaughter or whatever he might have been charged with, but after the public image of Darcy Allen Shepard had been so damaged, she was able to convince the Crown that it wasn't even worth putting him on trial. It's like the victory in the court of public opinion was so triumphant that it superseded the need for there to be a court process. This guy, we're not even going to put him on trial because there's no reasonable chance of conviction.
It's not uncommon in and of itself, I should say, for it to happen, that additional facts come out in an investigation that causes police prosecutors, actually, usually, to doubt that there is a reasonable prospect of conviction in a given situation. And so this sort of created the legend from that initial shift and rough shift in public opinion, even in the days after this incident, sort of created the legend of Navigator. I specifically remember this Linda Diebel article in The Star, where she wrote that, you know, it's a reasonable bet that you too, Toronto Star readers, have an opinion about this situation. But is it, you might ask, your own? Definitely not, says a veteran Toronto criminal lawyer, loath to have his name published. Look, the headline on this story should be Navigator changing your perceptions without you even knowing it. And I've been fascinated with them ever since.
Navigator changes the public perception.
Changing your perceptions without you even knowing it.
That's chilling.
It is. It's amazing. That's why I've been so fascinated with them. For his part, Watt later told the magazine that was then called the Ryerson Review of Journalism that he saw Navigator's role in the Michael Bryant case as countering misinformation and a pack mentality setting in amongst reporters. Quote, things were being reported that were not true, that Bryant left the scene of the accident, that he was drunk, that he would be in court on October 19th when it was just an initial appearance by his lawyer. If we'd let them go, they would have set like cement. We did what we needed to do to change the dimensions of the story, and then we stopped talking. Yeah, that's when you and I became aware of Navigator, but for other people, I think many probably became aware of them through Gian Gomeshi.
The story of what really led to the firing of a popular CBC radio host, Gian Gomeshi, keeps developing. Gomeshi's high-profile Toronto PR firm explaining today why they dropped him.
Sources say Gomeshi lied to his crisis management team, Navigator, about how many women could potentially come forward. In his infamous Facebook rant, he wrote it on his own, with no input from his advisors. Until finally, late yesterday, Navigator decided its moral code precluded the company from continuing to represent Gomeshi.
I can actually take people through this. I remember it pretty well. First, it came through an unnamed source that Navigator had been advising Gian Gomeshi in handling his scandal of being exposed and accused of being a sex predator, but that they had fired their own client. And that came to the press anonymously, and that was followed up from a rare official statement from Navigator saying that they had parted company and they no longer represented Gian Gomeshi. And the details that were reported were that it is common practice in crisis communications that whatever you did, you need to tell your crisis communication firm. It's rare, I think, for them to say, what you have done, sir, is so horrible that we can't represent you. That doesn't break the rules. What breaks the rules is we can only defend you if we know what you did. And Gomeshi reportedly, and the Toronto Star reported this, Kevin Donovan with Jacques Gallant, they had been told by their source that Gomeshi had assured Navigator that the accusation was coming from one bitter, disgruntled ex and a freelance journalist who didn't like him, and that was me. What Navigator reportedly did not know was that there were many, many, many other women. And reportedly, when they found out that they were dealing with many more accusers than Gomeshi had told them, they let him go as a client.
Yeah, what Gian Gomeshi himself later wrote in the New York Review of Books when he tried to have this, you know, not successful reintroduction to the public sphere. In an essay, he wrote that the professional team that I had hired as experts to guide me through the explosion bolted too. but not before they had cheered on some ill-advised social media postings and threatened lawsuits.
See, that's interesting that they cheered on his ill-advised social media, because that is classic Navigator playbook, as you were describing earlier. Get ahead of the story, tell your version of
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So that was a fatal error in this case. The Toronto Star had dropped the story before that, but once Gomeshi exposed himself and made this a public matter, that's when the Star got back on the phone with me and said, come back immediately, we want the story back. And I can see the merit to Navigator's strategy, but maybe the issue there is, if they had known that there was so much more that he was hiding, they would have said, do not post that.
All those initial steps were the Navigator hallmarks of getting a statement out that frames it in your terms. In that case, it was about supposedly consensual BDSM relationships, as well as launching a lawsuit, a wrongful dismissal suit against the CBC, which was very short-lived.
That was a PR lawsuit.
Yes, because it was very clear to legal observers, basically, Gian Gomeshi was a unionized employee, and generally unionized employees can't sue for wrongful dismissal. There's a whole grievance and arbitration process.
It was not a credible lawsuit. It was to show I'm fighting back.
Yes.
And it worked, until it didn't. It worked in terms of getting everyone from Elizabeth May, Judy Rebick, you know, he had feminists and progressives coming to his aid. But then when it became clear that there were, you know, by the time I was done reporting with the Star, there were 8 accusers, and then that number climbed above 20, and then everybody ran for cover. Jonathan, clearly I could talk about the Gomeshi case at some length, but let's not do that any further. That was almost a decade ago that people learned about Navigator through that case. What has become of Navigator since? Because it doesn't seem like they've ever disappeared. If anything, they just seem to be a more powerful or more present presence than ever.
If we're talking about the court of public opinion, which is where Navigator generally fights, it is much louder, faster, and all-enveloping than it has ever been, thanks to social media. And I mean, I don't like the term cancel culture, but if you're talking about what does it mean for public opinion to turn on someone or something fairly abruptly, they have managed to, you know, from the very early days of social media, really develop a practice around trying to both basically trying to insert themselves in that and trying to harness it and trying to deflect it and trying to get inside. There are lots of Jamie Watt speeches from around 2011, so like early-ish Twitter days, where he talks about the importance of rapid response. And conversely, from a campaigns and strategy perspective, he talks about activating the edge, about how you can use social media to mobilize your most loyal and ardent supporters to convey your message for you.
I think I see exactly what you mean. I mean, what's happened in the time since Gomeshi? Me Too has happened after Gomeshi. Whether we like the term or not, the fact that you can go from having a golden brand to being dragged by millions, canceled, as it were, that can happen in hours. If you are somebody with something to lose, if you are elite, if you are part of the establishment, if you have a big company or a big brand, these are the years where I like, how do I build a moat around this? Whether you're in crisis or not, that must be something that powerful people live in fear of like never before. This is probably a really good era to be in crisis communications. And I guess that Michael Bryant and John Gomeshi established Navigator as the go-to crisis communications firm. So this has just been like the solid years for Navigator.
So Navigator aims itself, I think of aiming itself to have people with something to lose, whether it's power, status, reputation, money. And losing those things, largely thanks to the court of public opinion, has never been easier or faster. And so, yeah, to be able to brand yourselves essentially as the defenders of the things that you already have, that you do not want to lose, and that you're willing to pay quite a bit of money to protect, that's been a good business strategy.
Jonathan, knowing that they worked with Gomeshi, knowing that they worked for Bryant before I covered that story, but, you know, having that knowledge, and then knowing that there is that connection with We Charity, I've often wondered when sending questions to powerful people, when conducting investigations, when doing journalism, am I actually dealing with Navigator here? Sometimes things can change really, really quickly. Like you get used to the patterns of response that somebody ignores your questions for a certain amount of time, or they answer quite tersely. And then all of a sudden you get really expansive responses from them and the tone of the communications shift. And I'm like, wait, did they just bring in Navigator? I often find myself wondering if they are a player in these stories, and that might sound, I don't know, paranoid or something, or fixated on them, but they do pop up in so many major news stories.
Yeah, I mean, just in the past year and a half or so, they've come into the news, into big national news on a few occasions, working for Hockey Canada, trying to help them get past their scandals with limited success.
That's an interesting one, because I recognize the playbook there. When an institution is coming under fire, and they say, we got this. We're going to strike our own committee to investigate ourselves.
We'll strike a committee to advise or to help guide a path forward.
You're telling the public that we're taking this scandal seriously, but you're also taking control of your own scandal. Like, you're because who gets to determine what that board is and what its scope is, so, and
this
who's
was,
on it?
So yeah, so there was like a story reported by CBC and others in August of 2022 about how Marnie McBean, who's a Canadian Olympian,